welcome back again. It's good to see each of you here all through the afternoon. There is a person I want to introduce to you here from the Geoscience Research Institute. I don't see him right now, but he was sitting right over there, Dr. and Mrs. Brown. Dr. Brown, are you here? Please stand. There he is. Dr. Brown is the former director of the Geoscience Research Institute. I want to thank you, Dr. Brown, for your work that you have done. We appreciate you coming all the way to be with us on this weekend here. Now, Randy talked a little bit about Anza Borrega Park, and I know this is not my... I just want to say a little footnote to that. We went down there to Anza Borrega Park with Buchheim to check out this large lake that had dried with this new mud in it. And as he mentioned, we both were there to dig. And so they put Randy out a nice place. He's the chief digger. And I was the associate digger, and they put me over to a place here. And I had my shovel, and down I went. And I went down about 2 feet, 2.5 feet. And as I dug down, I could see on the sides those barbs. And it was just thrilling all of us, you know, to see those barbs right there. And we could see the small bushes around, and the mud was clear up to the bush level. We knew it was done rapidly. But how are you going to show it factually? So I got down to about 2 to 2.5 feet, and the shovel struck something hard. So I looked at it, and it was just sand. So I said, aha, I have come now down to the floor, the floor of Anza Borrega Park, that the people would come and walk and, you know, have their campsites and so on. And there I was. I had struck the bottom where I was right there. Well, I said, you know, we should widen this out a bit. So I dug, and so I had a pit about there, 4 feet or so. And I was down there looking at that hard packed sand. It was the floor of Anza Borrega Park. And I could see that 2.5 feet with those hundreds of barbs. And then I took my shovel and I said, let's go a little deeper. Had no reason to do it. I said, well, it's... So I started to dig that hard packed sand down, down. And I was keeping close to the edge. And after I'd gone down about 4 or so inches, I just chopped down once again, and my shovel hit something metallic. What in the world is this? So I carefully dug around and dug underneath, you know, and upflipped. There it was, upflipped a metal mayonnaise jar lid. It was a Best Foods mayonnaise jar. And I looked at that thing and I said, Randy, you know, here. So our chief archaeologist came over and we looked at it. And he said, let me look at that thing. I wonder what could we do with that. And so he brought some water over, and Paul came over, and we began to pour some water on that, and Randy began to wash and to wipe the top of that mayonnaise jar bottle, tin lid, and you could see it begin to clean off. There was some rust there, and there the date began to emerge. It was a date insured. There it was with the life on it. Now that was about 1994. And the shelf life, if I remember, was about 7 years earlier. There it was stamped on there in the late 80s, September in the late 80s. I mean, scientific evidence that we've got 300 to 400 shards, 300 or 400 barbs, at least in those few years. That was really a wonderful moment. Now I want to share one thing, and then I want to, I'm watching the clock very carefully. We don't want to run over. We want to make sure everyone has their time. So I just wanted to give you a footnote, and this is sort of an unrelated footnote, but we want to keep ourselves and you abreast of the latest research. And remember last night I mentioned that macroevolution, we believe, is a theory, whereas microevolution is a fact. And then secondly, we suggested that macroevolution is a theory in crisis. I just want to share with you this, and then I'll go to our next topic. Scientists have just recently reported a discovery of a new fossil south of Melbourne, Australia. Maybe you have seen that report. It was reported this month, this very month, in the scientific journals, and in a semi-popular journal, but it had been funding this research for many decades. And the fossil has quite a name. Let's see if I can do it here. It's Osk Tribos Phenos Nyctos. That's the new fossil that's been discovered. And it is a shrew-sized placental mammal. Shrew-sized placental mammal. Underscore placental. Because in the evolutionary theory, the placental mammals did not enter Australia until 5 million years ago. 5 million. But Osk Tribos Phenos Nyctos was discovered in an undisturbed bed, and that's very, very important for scientific understanding, undisturbed bed of early Cretaceous. So that is 115 million years ago. And so Dr. Rich and his wife, Tricia, who were reporting this, said, this is a fossil in the wrong place at the wrong time. And they suggested that if this is so, we are going to need to rethink our basic ideas of the origin and evolution of mammals. Have to rethink. Now, I would like to look at the fossil forest in Yellowstone. We're going to go to the slides in just a minute. But this has been a real pleasure for me. I have come late on the scene, and my participation has been the privilege of accompanying some of the expeditions to bring back samples and to go on some expeditions looking for some very important sites of volcanoes in regard to this research. The lead scientists in this research, of course, Dr. Coffin and Dr. Clyde Webster. Dr. Clyde Webster, perhaps you've heard him speak. We'll show him on the slides in a minute. Dr. Clyde Webster has heard about the problem of the fossil forest in Yellowstone. Let me explain the potential problem to us as creationists. In Yellowstone fossil forests in Wyoming, there is a hillside which is called Specimen Creek. And it's called Specimen Creek because the river down there, small little creek, used to have specimens of fossil trees, little bits of broken off fossilized trees. Those have all now, since long ago, been taken up by visitors and they're gone, but it's still named Specimen Creek. So people have gone up, scientists have gone up, and they have discovered on this hillside vertical trees, fossilized. Then you'll have a shorter one, then maybe a larger one, maybe a real, real short one, and so forth. Some of these are exposed. Now, if we could dig away the whole hillside, we would find buried in there vertical fossilized trees, like so. The critics of recent creation suggest, look, here are a series of vertical trees which grew in situ, meaning from seeds right there in that very location. And the debate is, did they grow from seeds or were they somehow transported in there through some catastrophism, through some catastrophic mechanism? Because there are not only three fossilized so-called forests, there are over 72. 72, one on top of the other. Now, any simple grade school mathematics, you could see the significant problem. Some of these trees have rings 500. You can count them there and see them there. So you can see you can begin to multiply. Well, how long does it take to grow that tree? 500, 600, 700 years, all right? Then they were destroyed, according to the evolutionary theory, somehow. Then You don't grow a tree right on top of a tree. You've got to have soil. Therefore, deposits had to somehow come in, and then soil had to be formed. And then accidentally seeds had to come in, and another forest had to take root and grow. All that requires time. And when you add it all up, you have easy 100,000 years, 70 to 150,000 years. I mean, that is clear. If, in fact, all of these trees actually grew there from a seed. Now, let me just give you a little background of the human interest with Clyde Webster. Clyde Webster has his Ph.D. in geochemistry, earned from Denver, the university there in Denver, Colorado. This was in the 70s. He got out of his, he had his Ph.D., he went to get a job. Sorry, no work. He couldn't find a job anywhere, and therefore he said, I'm going to go back to my machine shop. So he went back to his old work in the machine shop. He went, knocked on the door, please, and the manager came. He said, I need a job. And the manager says, well, what kind of education do you have? I have a Ph.D. Sorry, you're no good. You're too educated. Well, listen, Clyde is a very practical fellow. And he said, wait a minute. He took the challenge and he said, what would you like me to turn? And so the owner of the machine shop gave him the most difficult assignment. And Clyde said, how many would you like? Can you just give me one? All right, thank you. And so Clyde prayed. He didn't have too much knowledge of what to do, but the Lord, he says, Lord, help me. And so he went to the back of the machine shop, and by mid-afternoon, he had six of them. He went back to the owner and showed him one, and the owner said, I can't believe this. You did all these this afternoon? Yes. How did you do it? And Clyde told him, and he says, I don't believe you. You show me. And so he went back there, and he began to show the owner how he did that. And the owner's face just was amazed. He said, Clyde, I've been working all my life in the machine shop, and I do it a different way. But the way you showed me is even better than I have known. You're hired. Clyde spent 6 months with him. He got him a taxi cab one day to go across Denver on a mission for the machine shop. He thought he recognized the driver of the taxi cab. Halfway across Denver, he said, I've got to talk to the cabbie and have him turn around. So he talked, and the cabbie turned around, and there Clyde was looking into the face of another, one of his Ph.D. buddies. The Ph.D. buddy couldn't get a job, and so he went to driving a cab. His friend was an entrepreneurial type, and he said, Clyde, you know, we worked this thing together. Let's start a company. We need $100,000 venture capital. And the taxi cab driver says, I think I know of a source in England. Will you come with me? Clyde said, all right, let's go. And so they went to London. They came back in 2 weeks with $100,000 venture capital. And they started their soil and mineral analysis company. Now, I'm making a long story short. Their company was so accurate and had instruments and ways of analysis, was so accurate that they could take three piles of filings, say, for example, lead, tin, and copper, take an exact measured teaspoon from each one, melt it, put it into an ingot, do their particular analysis, spectrometry, and stuff, etc. They would come up with a certain, what they called a chemical fingerprint. They would go back to the same three piles, take a teaspoon measured from each one, put through analysis, it would have a different chemical fingerprint. Extremely significant. Clyde knew about the Yellowstone problem. He said, this is amazing. But before he went for his baseline study, he knew that in Vietnam, some of our jets were crashing and the pilots were being killed because the fan blades were failing. He said to the government, give me a sample of one of those fan blades that had failed. They did. And Clyde gave the analysis, said, trace this back to your to the pour, trace it back to the engines that have not failed, and take all the fan blades that have this chemical fingerprint. They did. Clyde Webster saved our U.S. government millions of dollars and the lives of our pilots. Armed with this information, Clyde went to Hawaii. Why? He knew that in Hawaii, we have volcanoes which have eruptions that have been recorded over the years. Because the missionaries were there beginning. You know, Dole wasn't there. The Dole family didn't go to Hawaii to make money on pineapples. They were missionaries. Later they became entrepreneurs for pineapples. But the early missionary Dole family kept records. And they would keep the records when the volcanoes went off. And they have actually records that go back to 1700. Clyde knew about this. He went there. And he found this one volcano that had records from 1750 right up through to the mid-1900s. And he went up through the various flows and he took samples all the way to the top. And then he went and he sent them through the analysis. He found out that the different flows have different chemical fingerprints. And then he found on the side of the mountain a vent. And from this vent came several flows in rapid succession. He measured those. He sent them through analysis. And he found now a control result. He found that the 1980 to 1981, there were four different vent pulsations. And 1980 January, the pulsation was, let's just say, in the triangle shape for illustration purposes. 1980, 3 months later, it was still a triangle. In the mid-1980, the triangle was beginning to take a different shape. And by the end, so 1981, it was a circle. And that was a control. He learned then that the chemical fingerprint will change coming from the same magma chamber. It changes their ingredients that come in that give it a different fingerprint. Now, with that information, he went back here. Because interspersed through these fossil trees are ash stringers. We call that when an ash stringer, it's an explosion from the volcano like Mount St. Helens, and there are ash layers all through there. So now, armed with this information, he went back here and he climbed up all 72 layers, taking samples. He had 124 samples. He sent it through the lab. He didn't know what he was going to get back. He had 127 different layers. He could have had 120 different chemical fingerprints. And this is what he found. He found only four different chemical fingerprints. Only four in all those 124 layers. Only four. And then he discovered that they were interfingered randomly. That there was like a zero here. Now just right here. A zero. Then they went to triangles. Two, three, four triangles. Then a zero. And then into a box. And then to a squiggle. And then back to a zero. And whatever. And that's the way we're interfingered. Just four. And then he discovered, his third discovery was that at the bottom of these 72 forests, let's say they were like zeros, and at the very top he found another series of zeros. So there were zeros at the bottom and zeros at the top in terms of chemical fingerprints of the ash layers. Now, what did that show to him? Incredible! He found in Hawaii that the fingerprint will change after a year has gone by. If a year has not gone by, the fingerprint will not change. So when he found the fingerprint zeros here at the bottom and zeros at the top, how much time had gone by? Less than a year. Therefore, the conclusion is all of these fossil forests had somehow been deposited in there in less than 1 year and not 100,000 years. Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
1 year, not 100,000 years. Now, what about the four different fingerprints? What did that mean? That meant that there were four different volcanoes pulsating, interrupting, the eruptions spontaneously, randomly pulsating, going off at different times during that year. And that we could say then that there was a volcano, let's say volcano number zero over here, and it would spew out. Then there was volcano number squiggle up here, and it would spew out. Then there was volcano triangle, over here. And this volcano would give its pulsation of ash. And then there was volcano box up here. And it would come into this basin at random times. And so then we said, let's see if we can find those volcanoes. And that's what we've been doing. And let me bring you to the latest things. We have discovered three of these volcanoes to date. Clyde was mentioning this to one of the park rangers who was a geologist. And when he was mentioning that, he believed that these basinal research suggested that all the debris had come in from four volcanoes. His eyes lit up and he said, Clyde, have you seen this particular research paper? Clyde hadn't seen it. It's like finding a needle in a haystack, probably not on the web or internet. Anyway, he said, here's the address for it. So he got it. A team of United States geologists had come through this area several years before, and they studied the area, and they concluded, we conclude that Specimen Creek is the result of the activity of four different volcanoes. Independent, cooperative evidence. We went to Lone Mountain. Lone Mountain is about 28 miles south of Specimen Creek. I'm going to take you there just a second. And we took samples. And the samples from Lone Creek matched up with one of the fingerprints. We went to Electric Peak taking samples. Those samples matched up with another one of the volcanic fingerprints. We've gone to the north of Specimen Creek, and there's an outcrop that is the third. We are right, that's as far as we've gone. We have not found the fourth one yet. So let's go, and I want to take you in my conclusion will be one of the most remarkable things we found at Specimen Creek, and I will mention that as we're looking at the slides. Thank you for helping me there. So if we could have the lights out, please, all the church lights, and we'll look at the slides. This is Clyde Webster and his daughter, Laura. We're signing in to go look at Specimen Creek. There are three spotlights. If these could be turned off, I'd appreciate it as well. Thank you. Maybe that will help. Thank you. So we head on up the trail, and we find little fellows like this. This is the trail we were walking on. And that's not a telephoto lens. That's how close you can sometimes get to these little guys. Now we're at the trail. We take off to go up to Specimen Creek. Now, the gentleman in the back is Dr. Coffin. And the gentleman in front, that's Clyde. Now, that's a tree over here. I like to play once in a while. And I was standing taking a picture. And just for fun, I took out my knife and said, I think I can, you know how you try to sling your knife and see if it can stick in? Well, mine hit the tree and fell down. And these fellows did the thing, and their knife stuck right in, those rascals. So we moved on up out of the trail. Now the next slide, I think, is one of the most important. Any of my colleagues, we agree that we could share with you, and this is it. This is called Cathedral Point. And Dr. Webster, Dr. Coffin, they mentioned, whenever we go on research like we are today, not just taking visitors to see, we always stop right here and we ask God to guide us. And I want you to know that to me that really touched me. And they said, we need to pray. And I said, could I take a picture while we are praying? They said, yes. And so I took a picture of this, and we want to thank God for any of the research that gives glory to Him. We believe that God is guiding, because we must do good science and not try to read into the rocks the answers we want. Isn't that true? We must only find what is there. God can guide us in these efforts. And so we see now some of the results of the major erosional features. We find many of these perched and balanced rocks like that. Here is the Specimen Creek Ridge. Right up the hill there. This is Dr. Coffin. Right up here is one of the largest trees. We'll come closer. I've sort of named that what I like to call General Sherman or whatever. Anyway, there he is. Now here is Dr. Coffin on the left and Clyde to the right, and the largest standing fossil tree right there. And one of the most interesting things is at the bottom of these trees, the detritus, or the things you'll find dropping down, do not match the species of the tree. These are needle trees, and you find large, wide, deciduous trees, leaves at the bottom. In other words, you find the biologically they're mixed up, which suggests non-in-situ growth. Now here's a little side of the hillside which gives you some idea of these fossilized trees. There's the largest one. And each year it wears away. Now we're going to see something interesting here. Here is the bottom end or the root end of the butt end, and it comes along like so. These trees were overlapping. If these trees grew there from seeds, this guy outlasted when the blast came and everything. How could he last and still stand straight up when you have overlapping like that if it's through catastrophism when these are broken down? These suggest transport. Dr. Coffin is pointing to the bottom end there. Now we've turned around and we look down the valley. And I want to point this out, and there's another slide that'll give you a little more detail. Please notice the shear pattern or the breaking pattern at the top of General Sherman. Dr. Coffin is pointing to a phenomenon that we see there, and this is sorting. You see large cobbles going to finer ones. When we see something like that, that is suggestive of water action. And we're happy to find it. So here we have evidence of water action. Now this harps back to this morning's presentation. Could it be that Mount St. Helens has provided a marvelous analog for how we got those vertical trees? Here you see the blast coming at the steam coming at 500 miles an hour and the slurry coming at 200 miles an hour underneath there. Look at those matchsticks. This is something that the power of God's flood could also produce. Look at that forest of downed trees. Look how big they are. Notice here you see the ash blast side, which knocked that tree over. See the blast sanding there? Now, this is interesting. When the pilots flew over after the blast, they looked down into Spirit Lake, that's Spirit Lake right there, and they said, oh no, we've lost our lake to entrance of sand. And they thought these were all, the brown stuff there on the water was sand. And they said, oh no, our lake is gone. It wasn't sand, it was a log mat. There it is. And so they went down, and Dr. Coffin said, we must go down and see whether or not some trees had begun to float vertically. And so they went down, and sure enough, as you saw in the film this morning, some of these stump-like features are not little short stumps sitting there. Those are the exposed ends of a vertical tree that's floating down. These are like icebergs. In other words, when all the trees finally were on the surface, they were floating horizontally. And then over time, some of those trees began to swing down like this and to take a vertical position. They were floating vertically at first, and then they began to swing down. And some of those were then vertical. And all those little short stubby knobs indicate a tree that is floating vertically. So they went down into the water. You can see how they lost 1,000 feet up there on the top. Now here are the two divers that are going to take us down. We're looking up. There are the vertical. Those are the horizontal trees, and then we come to this famous vertical floating tree. And the neat thing is about it, there's no creationist pushing on that with a wire hanging it, you know, pulling down to the bottom. That just did it naturally. There it is, the testimony. Isn't that amazing? So therefore, they went to find out how many of those were. I would just put this slide in to show you. Here's a vertical tree, a little girl at the bottom there, for scale. And then the conglomerate kind of breccia that is surrounding that vertical tree.
Question?
Yes. Oh, 50 feet to 100, 50 feet, something like that. So here's now back to Spirit Lake, and you see one of these vertical trees. Notice that it's getting wider at the bottom. We're coming down to the bottom end or to the butt end for the reason to see whether or not, what do those roots look like? Let's get a little further down. Now we're widening out, way out. The next slide, you can see some of the roots. There they are. And those roots have been broken. But they're right there. They've been anchored, and they've drifted along, and they've anchored into the mud. They've grounded. There's like a floating iceberg grounded right there. Now, it's interesting. This brown material below it is the peeled bark and into the bits. Because the trees that were lying horizontal on the lake were all debarked. Where did all that bark go? Down at the bottom. And so, if more sedimentation came in, and this lake were drained, somebody would come there and think, well, this tree grew there, but it really didn't. So now we're back into Yellowstone, and you can see General Sherman standing there, and there, the material which once surrounded General Sherman, but now has been washed away recently. They wanted to find out how many trees were there. And you remember this morning, according to the picture, they found about, 20,000. Those white vertical white lines are shadows of a vertical tree underwater. Now, here we are. We're sitting on the surface of Spirit Lake, and we're looking down vertically to a tree that's floating vertically, and you're looking at the top of it. Let the pattern burn into your heart and to your mind. Look at that pattern, that sheer pattern. That tree was growing just a few months before on the hillside. And now it's underwater, hanging there vertically. But look at that breakage pattern, that shear pattern, in comparison to that. That's General Sherman. See the shear pattern up there at the top? You see that? You see the comparison. Now let's go back to the one in Spirit Lake. Now let's go to Yellowstone. Exactly the same, isn't it? Could it be that this tree underwent similar pressures that one went under? Again, could it be that this General Sherman was subjected to the similar kinds of pressures and powers which that Douglas fir was subjected to in Spirit Lake? So there we have an analog, the same kind of thing. Now we're going to go to Lone Lake, Lone Mountain. This mountain was one of the sources of the 72 layers there of those ash stringers. Now we'll come a little closer. This is a volcano. And this is a ski resort area now. Let me ask a show of hands. Have any of you been to Lone Mountain? Let me see your hands. Anyone here in our congregation today? Okay. It is a beautiful place. And the folks back in Idaho and Wyoming and Michigan, they love to go to Lone Mountain to ski. So we went there to test the ash layers. Now there's Clyde, there's his daughter, and we took this very lift up to our place where we wanted to take the samples. And I tell you, Clyde said, this is the finest way to get your work I've ever known. You get whisked up to that place in a gondola. It was really wonderful. So we got up there, and here you see the top of Lone Mountain. And we come on over here to the left side. This is called the south flank. The south flank of Lone Mountain. This is all ash. Lithified ash by now. It's like hard sandstone, but it once was airborne, and then it solidified. So we took samples from there, and we took them back, and yes, they matched one of the fingerprints from Specimen Creek. Now, we went back just about a year and a half ago to redouble check the information and our samples. And here's the story I want to close with. We went back there. Coffin, Clyde Webster, myself, and another friend, the four of us were there. We paid our tickets, paid the motel, got the rented car, you know, all the expenses, and we arrived Sunday morning. Normally, that's a wonderful morning for skiing and everything. We got there to resample the south flank of Lone Mountain. Can you believe it? When we got there, here was a great big sign, big banner. And it said, "Mountain closed to climbing." Oh, my. I tell you, that put a dagger through each of us. We couldn't believe it. We had come all the way to go back there and resample the south flank. Mountain closed to climbing. Oh, my. Well, you know, we don't give up too easily. So we tried to get a hold of a CEO, somebody that would have enough authority to say, could hear our story and to say, yes, you're a scientist attempting to do some research. It'll be limited in scope and it'll be all right. Couldn't find anybody. Well, we waited until the tram opened up and the gondolas, and we paid our money. At least they were taking visitors up and back. So he said, we'll go for the ride and come back. At least we want to go up and get as close as we can to the mountain. So we got into the gondola and we rode to the top. And as we got off the gondola, guess what met us? Big sign, mountain closed to climbing. Well, we looked around, up at the mountain, down, and coming up the ravine was a pickup. And Clyde says, I'm going to run down there and stop that pickup. And so Clyde ran down, the pickup came on up, it missed Clyde. Clyde started to run, waving his arms, and we saw that the pickup stopped. And Clyde went up and talked to the driver, talked for a while, quite a while. All of a sudden, he whirled around, he ran back up, and as he came up, he said, we're out of here. We got permission to go to the north flank, right there. That's the north flank. We didn't want to go to the north flank. We wanted to go to the south flank to resample, to double-check our publication, so that we can publish. This material has not been published yet. And it's high time it's published. No, you have to go to the north flank. And then we knew why. Here came a huge helicopter right over then with a large bucket hanging down. And it was heading toward the summit. And as we looked toward the summit, we could see a small little arm reach over. It was a backhoe way up there on the summit. And we could hear it working. And we could hear the rocks coming down. What they were doing, they were building a chairlift to the very top of the mountain. And they understandably didn't want anybody to be hurt. So temporarily, the mountain was closed to climbing. But they gave us permission to go to the north flank because we were out of the flight path of the helicopter. So we went over to the north flank here, and we went up this ravine right up in here. We had our lunch, and then we started down. We found some interesting things. It was just nice to be over there. We took some samples to see if they would match also, which they did. As we turned around to come down, Dr. Coffin spotted something. He reached down, he picked it up, and Dr. Coffin has a sense of humor. He took this material, which he had found, and he went over to Clyde, and he turned it over so Clyde couldn't see what he had seen, and he held it under his face just like that. He said, Clyde, do you see any organics in there? Now, organics, you know, we'd love to see organics in there. That would mean, do you see any imprints of a shell or anything like that? You know, and Clyde would love to say, yes, you bet, look what you found. And so Clyde, you know, you have to do good science. And a negative discovery is important. So he looked there and he studied that thing. And he said, I'm afraid I don't see anything. Now, footnote. coffin has eyes like a hawk. Like eyes like an eagle. We were just with him 2-3 weeks before that. We were walking along the trail of a mountain in some high grass. All of a sudden, Dr. Coffin started flailing his arms like this, like a helicopter. And he jumped down like, he came up like this, and he had a wriggling snake in his hands. He can spot it like that. And he can spot it just like that, that it's not poisonous. And he can think, I want my folks to see it. He can grab it for you and show it just like that. And so this man, who has eyes like that, he went over, and after he'd showed this to Clyde, he turned it over. And then he said, will that convince you?
Oh,
oh my. And what he had seen there, what he had found, undisturbed shells in ash of all things, that electrified us. We came back the next day. We changed our plans. We came back the next day, and we went back up that ravine, right up this way. I went up, and I had the privilege of bending over and picking up and actually finding a reed that it was in ash of all things. Then we went up to the top, Clyde and I, went over, and we shouted down. I remember shouting down to my colleagues, and I said, they were still coming up the original ravine. I said, have you found anything? And they shouted back, we're loaded. And this is what we found. This is undisturbed ash from Lone Mountain. What are these shells doing here? I mean, Dr. Coffin was speechless. To these men, this is more significant than it is to me. I'm a newcomer to this. But to these seasoned geologists, the implications, what are we going to do? It's incredible. They took back these samples. These are not reworked impressions of shells. They're very clean. To date, the best analysis of these shells indicate that they are Cretaceous shells. The ash is Eocene ash. Now, according to evolutionary theory, the ash is about 35 to 40 million years ago. Whereas the shell, according to evolutionary theory, is 65 million years ago. Very interesting. Things are collapsing. Time is collapsing. The point is, we have evidence of aquatic activity 28 miles from Specimen Creek. Now, here's a picture of that reed which we found. And then here is a picture of ripple marks. Ripple marks are made. This is ash, and this is ripple marks. That's made by water action. So here we have water action, evident right there, 28 miles from Specimen Creek. And so the picture is coming together little by little. And it's all coming to point towards some catastrophic deposition of Specimen Creek. Something that is consistent with what we expect in the proportion of the flood mentioned in Genesis 6 to 9. And so I'd like to end with this, by now, our picture of the rainbow connection. That we thank God that there was a global, planet-wide flood, ultimately responsible in the long run, after much research, for the kinds of catastrophic events we find recorded in Yellowstone. And so that concludes the presentation of the latest research on the Yellowstone fossil forest.
This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you would discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.